We begin with an article out of WVWnews.net. It's called, once again, "The So-Called Extremists Were Right." Well, it appears that Hillary has let the cat out of the bag. For those who do not believe that the Council on Foreign Relations runs the show, read this. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is not yet a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. After her July 15th speech at the CFR's branch office in the nation's capital, she may never be offered membership. Why? Because she frankly and unequivocally stated what CFR bigwigs have never wanted known. Mrs. Clinton confirmed that critics of the CFR are correct, that the organization directs the U.S. government's policies and steers our country in ways that are harmful to its survival as an independent nation. Her remarks point to CFR members, who have long been working against the best interests of the American people. Introduced for her speech by Council President Richard N. Haass, Hillary began by thanking him for his kind words and expressing delight at being asked, at being able to be at the relatively new CFR outpost down the street from the State Department. She noted that she had often been inside the mothership in New York City, meaning the CFR's main headquarters at Park Avenue and 68th Street. But after issuing these innocuous pleasantries, she told her very friendly audience, quote, "We get a lot of advice from the council, so this will mean I won't have to go as far to be told what we should be doing and how we should think about the future." Close quote. Let me read that to you again. Hillary Clinton. "We get a lot of advice from the Council on Foreign Relations, so this will mean I won't have to go as far to be told what we should be doing and how we should think about the future." Close quote. The nation's Secretary of State has blown the CFR's cover. For decades, its officials and key members have protested that the organization is a mere think tank that never takes a position on any subject. But here we have our nation's chief foreign policy official admitting that the CFR will tell her what to do and how to think. And the State Department even published her amazing admissions on its website. Why her remarks are so amazing deserves an explanation. The CFR emerged in the aftermath of the U.S. Senate's rejection of our nation's membership in the League of Nations. Officially in business as of 1921, the organization's Foreign Affairs Journal immediately called for the creation of a world government and an end to U.S. sovereignty. The group's primary founder was President Woodrow Wilson's top aide, Edward Mandel House, the author of a book in which he admitted he was working for, quote, "socialism as dreamed of by Karl Marx," close quote. Marx, along with all the communists who revere him, also sought world government. Entire books have been written to expose the CFR, the most reliable being The Shadows of Power by James Perloff. If Mr. Perloff had the benefit of Hillary Clinton's stunning admission, he certainly would have included it in his widely distributed work. But he nevertheless did an excellent job in showing that, though through its strategically placed members, the CFR is a very powerful and extremely dangerous organization. Much evidence to back up that assertion can be assembled. We provide only a few examples of what should be termed indications of treasonous intent. In 1974, former State Department official Richard N. Gardner wrote in Foreign Affairs that the desired goal of world government could not be attained in a single leap, so he recommended performing, quote, "an end-around against national sovereignty, eroding it piece by piece," close quote. He said this could be accomplished via the IMF, the World Bank, a Law of the Sea Treaty, disarmament programs, a United Nations military force, and more. His urging, he contended, can produce some remarkable concessions on sovereignty that could not be achieved on an across-the-board basis. Close quote. It's worth noting that no member of the CFR resigned after these flagrantly un-American ideas appeared in their publication. It was even earlier that Georgetown University professor Carol Quigley revealed his awareness of the existence of a secret society to rule the world in his 1966 book, Tragedy and Hope. He calmly and delightedly mentioned that the U.S. branch of this grand undertaking was the Council on Foreign Relations. While accepting the Democratic Party's nomination for president in 1992, Georgetown alumnus Bill Clinton acknowledged that his mentor had been the very same Carol Quigley. Mr. Clinton has long held membership in the CFR, as did presidential predecessors Eisenhower, Kennedy, Nixon, and Bush the Elder, while they served, and Ford and Carter, who affiliated with the CFR soon after leaving the White House. A great deal more can be offered to confirm the subversive and un-American posture of this powerful organization. For instance, its leader for several decades was David Rockefeller. In 2002, his autobiography, entitled Memoirs, became available, referring to the enormous influence he and his family have exercised over our nation's affairs, he wrote, quote, "Some even believe we're a part of a secret cabal, working against the best interests of the United States, characterizing my family and me as internationalists, and of conspiring with others around the world to build a more integrated global political and economic structure, one world, if you will. If that's the charge, I stand guilty, and I'm proud of it." Close quote. Guilty of what? Guilty of conspiring with others to build a one-world government, the goal of the Council on Foreign Relations. If successful, Rockefeller and others who share his aim would cancel the Declaration of Independence and tear up the U.S. Constitution. And finally, in this very short listing of indictments of the organization, we turn to CFR President Richard N. Haass, the man who welcomed Mrs. Clinton to the CFR's office in D.C. In February 2006, the Taipei Times reported that he is no less a pupil of Edward Mandel House and no less an advocate of world government than any of his predecessors. In part, he stated, "For over 350 years, sovereignty, the notion that states are the central actors in the world stage and that governments are essentially free to do what they want within their own territory, but not within the territory of other states, has provided the organizing principle of international relations. The time has come to rethink that notion." The CFR lists only 4,338 members, but these individuals sit atop the world's business, mass media, academia, military, foundations, and government. They are, as Washington Post writer Richard Harwood once noted, America's ruling class. But they aren't supposed to admit that they have the power to direct U.S. policy. Now, however, Secretary of State Clinton has stated in very clear terms that what critics of the CFR have always maintained is correct. The CFR, she admits, tells her what to do and what to think. In following its lead, she's not alone. Americans who wonder why our nation's policies are so self-defeating, even un-American, must begin to understand that the Council on Foreign Relations is their main author. Repudiation of this organization, its members, and those who willingly accept direction from it, such as Ms. Clinton, is not just a good idea, it's a matter of national survival. My commentary for today, August the 1st. First item. Some law enforcement spokesmen are doing all they can to ruin what's left of their reputation amongst thinking Americans. An aged black professor is mistreated by an overzealous white police officer. President Obama comments on this egregious conduct, and law enforcement poobahs around the country jump to the defense of this absurd and egregious conduct, rather than admitting one of our own screwed up and does not represent the standards we wish to follow. It's gutless and sad that law enforcement does not have the self-confidence and self-esteem to feel it could admit when one of its own screws up. Next item is by Ken Thomas, Associated Press writer, out of Washington. John Conyers wants criminal probe of Bush's abuses. The chairman of the House Judiciary Committee on Friday urged Attorney General Eric Holder to appoint a special counsel to examine potential abuses by former President George W. Bush's administration. Representative John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, said in a speech to the National Press Club that Holder, quote, must appoint a special counsel to review the Bush administration abuses of power and misconduct. A criminal probe. He's got to do that. Close quote. Conyers' committee has sought an investigation of Bush administration moves, including its methods of interrogating foreign detainees, the use of warrantless wiretaps, alleged retribution against critics, and allegations that officials intentionally misused intelligence. Conyers said the criminal probe should be accompanied by a, quote, 9/11-type panel, close quote, to gather facts and make recommendations on preventing the misuse of power. My comment, let us pray it's anything but a 9/11-type whitewash panel. Back to his news release. Holder is considering whether to appoint a prosecutor to review only the Bush administration's method of interrogating suspected terrorists. President Barack Obama's expressed reluctance to conduct a probe into alleged Bush-era abuses and resisted an effort by congressional Democrats to establish a truth commission, saying the nation should be looking forward and not backwards. Conyers also called for the enforcement of subpoenas issued by his committee to former White House Chief of Staff John Bolton and White House lawyer Harriet Myers. Conyers said Bolton has, quote, lots of documents and all the breadcrumbs, as we call them, go right to the White House, close quote. Next item in my commentary. It's amazing to what lengths some people will go to oppose the nomination of President Obama. Obama has just nominated a guy named Paul Holdren as his chief science advisor. Critics at Fox News, that bastion of integrity, are claiming that Holdren favors forced abortion, forced sterilization, and other draconian measures to curb population growth. Their evidence? A book Holdren co-authored with two others 32 years ago. I don't know about you, but I shudder to think what I might have thought 32 years ago. Fortunately, memory being what it is, I can't recall if I thought anything at all 32 years ago. Next item. Sometimes Jeff Ackerman of the Grass Valley Union just nails it. This is one of those times. He calls it the Lessons of Callanan Park. It's by Jeff Ackerman. I don't know what all the fuss is about regarding the proposed opening of a medical marijuana dispensary in Nevada City. All we're talking about is moving Callanan Park indoors. Bingo. Two problems solved for the price of one. For decades, Nevada City fathers and mothers have been bemoaning the problems associated with the park, which was named after George Callanan, who spent 44 years as city clerk. This park sits at the entryway to their charming town. The first thing many tourists see is Billy and Sue and maybe Mary Lou smoking a joint at Callanan Park, right smack under the city's official Christmas tree and within eyeshot of the district attorney's new digs. And when Billy and Sue and Mary Lou aren't smoking pot in the park, they're hanging out in front of the town's stores and restaurants and bars, where visitors must sometimes step over them to spend money. City fathers and city mothers say Billy and Sue and Mary Lou have a constitutional right to sit on the sidewalks and to smoke whatever they smoke at the park, and they have been reluctant to tell them to get the hell out of town or go get a job or maybe even clean up after themselves. It took a group of volunteers most of a Saturday last summer to clean up the garbage at the park, and some of that garbage required rubber gloves and chemical masks. You shouldn't have to worry about stepping on crack or heroin or meth needles at a park. Certainly not in a park at the entrance to a charming city that was named after a city clerk. But when it comes to opening a medical marijuana dispensary, where people with doctor's recommendations can walk in and purchase some pot from someone other than Billy, Sue, or Mary Jo, well, that's just not going to happen. Not in our charming town. Not in a town that is officially a nuclear-free zone by ordinance. Last week, the Nevada City Council met to review an ordinance that would regulate medical marijuana dispensaries. They've done their homework, visiting a very good operation up in Colfax, where city leaders have reported no problems at all since the place opened years ago. The ordinance addressed the concerns that customers, many of them cancer victims and others who use marijuana to ease their pain, of the medical marijuana shop, would hang out in front all day smoking pot and generally making visitors and other shop owners uncomfortable, kind of like they do at Callanan Park. It also regulated the sales of pipes and other tools they use to smoke marijuana, the kind of tools the volunteers found when they cleaned up Callanan Park one hot Saturday. Other residents got wind that their elected officials were serious about allowing a medical marijuana shop to open in their town. They got mad. One even threatened to move his business to maybe Grass Valley, where nobody smokes pot, between the hours of 4 a.m. and 4:05 a.m., that is. Is Nevada City the right kind of place? Asked one councilman. Most people who would go to this medical marijuana dispensary wouldn't even be residents of Nevada City. Really? Are we talking about the same Nevada City? The city that embraces everything you'd find in, say, Berkeley, except a marijuana dispensary? Maybe he's right. Maybe Nevada City residents don't smoke marijuana, or at least buy it from a dispensary. If you believe that, then you probably think the folks hanging out in Callanan Park are representatives from Welcome Wagon. Nevada City Mayor Renette Senham gets it. She probably wonders how a marijuana dispensary will cause any more trouble than, say, a bar, where people get thrown through glass windows at 2 a.m. after an evening of tequila shots from a friend's belly button. Check out the police blotter sometime, or better yet, walk into the mine shaft at 1 a.m. and order a Pepsi. Then stroll down to Callanan Park and see if you can buy some pot. The proposed ordinance to regulate a medical marijuana dispensary is more rigid than any I've ever seen regulating bars, where all you need to do is show a driver's license in order to get drunk enough to wet your pants and kiss your dog in the mouth. For example, the ordinance would require the dispensary to have locked doors and a security guard to make sure drunks from the neighborhood bar can't just barge into the place and throw up all over the pot. It would also require that only patients with medical marijuana recommendations be allowed to purchase the stuff, and not just anyone who happens to walk over from Callanan Park. Operators would have to make sure people don't loiter, like they do in front of most of the other downtown businesses. And graffiti on the front walls, like maybe, "Gin rules, pot sucks," would be strictly forbidden. The city council is supposed to consider the ordinance again once they've talked to a few more people and gotten a better feel for the election polls. They may even wander down to Callanan Park to speak with some of the constituents there, maybe asking what they think the city ought to do to protect its charm. That was Jeff Ackerman writing in the Grass Valley Union. My comment. When I read about the contretemps over Callanan Park, two items stick out for me. Firstly, the myth that Callanan Park is the first thing tourists encounter upon entering our fair city, and as such must represent and present our town's best face, its highest and best qualities. I've got news for the propagators of that myth. Unless the tourists arrive by hitchhiking and then walk up from the freeway off-ramp, they probably drive right by the tiny park without even realizing it even exists. In case our city fathers and mothers haven't noticed, Nevada City's greatest turnoff for potential tourists is not Callanan Park and its collection of kids. It's our lack of parking. So tourists arriving to spend money in our boutiques and eateries are far too busy searching for a parking place to ever notice the kids populating that tiny park. The second thing that piques my interest is that the business owner most often quoted as being upset by the present state of the park is the only tourist-oriented business near the park, and that's the Beachfront Deli. What's wrong with this picture? Well, firstly, the name. Where's the beach? Last time I looked, there's no beach within maybe 20 miles. It should probably be named the Parkfront Deli, or the Bankfront Deli, as it faces the park and the side of a bank. This business is perhaps the newest business in the entire town, as it is housed in the most recent construction to be built in Nevada City. The park, in the exact condition it's in now, has existed for decades, before the deli across the street set up shop. Now, any real estate person worth talking to will tell you that the three most important factors of real estate are location, location, and finally, location. So one has a right to wonder why the proprietor chose that location for their enterprise, and to question why they are now complaining about a situation that existed long prior to their setting up shop. Was there some secret agreement that if they bought into the project, the city would clean up the neighborhood? If not, did they fail to notice the park, its kids, and their activities directly across the street? You get my drift? I think there's something inherently wrong with someone, be it person or business, moving into an area, and then forcing that area or its residents to change to suit the newcomer's wishes. It's sort of a no-brainer. If you don't like an area or your neighbors, don't move there. Next item. Just another comment on the hypocrisy of those opposed to single-payer health care. The determining argument seems to be that if we had government-funded single-payer, the private, for-profit insurance companies and HMOs could not compete. The logic suddenly gets twisted, as it is then stated as a truth carved in stone that we must protect these vultures' right to do business, and it would be unfair for them to have to compete with the government. Hello? Isn't competition and free market capitalism the foundation of all that they espouse? Well, yes, as long as it serves the corporate business community. As soon as it works against them, they become socialists of the first order. It's the ultimate hypocrisy. And the clearest example yet of the fact that our elected representatives don't represent us at all. They've sold out to corporate interests. Our representative system of government is totally compromised. A grand failure posing as democracy. It's a totally failed system. The time, for those of you keeping time, is 12:28 in the p.m. The place is Nevada City. The radio station, KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chambalain, the show Rabble Rousing. This is from a press release by Bernie Sanders, senator from Vermont. Fed secrecy and banker bonuses. Stepping up a campaign for Federal Reserve accountability, Senator Bernie Sanders on Wednesday questioned whether some of more than the $2.2 trillion in secret subsidies went to Goldman Sachs and other bailed-out banks now planning to shower executives with huge bonuses. Sanders voiced his concern in a letter to Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, and during remarks at an Economic Policy Institute conference. Goldman Sachs yesterday reported that its profits surged on second-quarter income of $3.44 billion. The turnaround came less than a year after reckless investments by Goldman and other Wall Street firms triggered a worldwide recession and drove many rivals out of business. With the good times rolling again on Wall Street, Goldman repaid its $10 billion taxpayer bailout and now plans to dole out the biggest bonuses in its 140-year history. The investment bank reported plans to pay as much as $20 billion this year in bonuses and other compensation, about $700,000 per employee. Goldman is one of 10 big banks that announced plans to return bailout funds so that they could evade restrictions on executive compensation and bonuses. Sanders asked, "The question I have is how do we know that right after Goldman and other banks pay back billions to the Treasury, the Federal Reserve doesn't turn around and provide them with billions more with no strings attached? The answer is we don't know. Ben Bernanke refuses to say." In a keynote speech at an Economic Policy Institute conference, Sanders argued that any firm that received a taxpayer bailout through the Troubled Asset Relief Program or the Federal Reserve should be subject to strict limits on compensation and should not be rewarding bonuses to senior executives. The Senate in April approved 59-39 an amendment by Sanders calling on the Fed to disclose the name of all of the institutions that received more than $2.2 trillion in taxpayer assistance, how much each received, and what they're doing with this money. The amendment was included in the final version of the budget resolution. Sanders also is the chief sponsor of legislation to require the Fed to name the financial institutions that have received what could total more than $7 trillion in loans and loan guarantees. A separate Sanders bill would require the Government Accountability Office to conduct a comprehensive and independent audit of the Federal Reserve. It now has 13 co-sponsors. Representative Ron Paul of Texas has introduced an identical bill in the House. It now has 261 co-sponsors, which include 85 Democrats. Sanders further said, "Chairman Bernanke and the Federal Reserve have got to understand that this money does not belong to the Federal Reserve. It belongs to the American people. As long as the Federal Reserve is allowed to keep this information on their loans secret, we will never know the true financial conditions of the banking system." To quote Bob Dylan, I just say good luck. Okay, Avi, would you like to read an article?
I would.
Okay. Okay, so let's...
Do you wonder how and why we won't have genuine health care reform? This article may illuminate. Six Centrist Senators Selling Us Out on Health Care by Barbara O'Brien from opednews.com. The health care bill is being held up by six centrist senators who meet daily to put together a bill that would have a broad bipartisan agreement, as opposed to a bill that would, you know, reform health care. David M. Herzenhorn and Robert Pear write in the New York Times, "The fate of the health care overhaul largely rests on the shoulders of six senators who since June 17th have gathered, often twice a day and for many hours at a stretch, in a conference room in the office of the Senate Finance Committee Chairman Max Baucus, Democrat of Montana. President Obama and congressional leaders agree that if a bipartisan deal can be forged on health care, it will emerge from this conference room. The battle over health care is all but paralyzed as everyone awaits the outcome of their talks. Why this little scenario needs to change right now. Already, the group of six has tossed aside the idea of a government-run insurance plan that would compete with private insurers, which the president supports but Republicans said was a deal-breaker. Instead, they are proposing a network of private, non-profit cooperatives. They have also dismissed the House Democrat plan to pay for the bill's roughly $1 trillion, 10-year cost, partly with an income surtax on high earners. The three Republicans have insisted that any new taxes come from within the health care arena. As one option, Democrats have proposed taxing high-end insurance plans with values exceeding $25,000. The Senate group also seems prepared to drop a requirement included in other versions of the legislation that employers offer to coverage to their workers. Quote, in the House, centrist Democrats have temporarily stalled the health care bill. Many lawmakers want to see what Mr. Baucus's group produces before voting on tax increases in the House bill. I read this first thing this morning, and I cannot tell you how sick I feel. That the lives of Americans rest with this corrupt little crew. End quote. At least some of them are essentially sponsored by Big Pharma and other parts of the medical industrial complex, who are major campaign contributors, is beyond outrageous. It is the utter failure of American democracy in microcosm. My favorite quote, if this is the only bill with bipartisan support, Ms. Snow said, that would really resonate. It could be the linchpin for broad bipartisan agreement, end quote. And of course, we need broad bipartisan agreement so much more than we need health care. These people need to hear from us. Senator Max Baucus, Montana, Democrat. Senator Jeff Bingaman, New Mexico, Democrat. Senator Kent Conrad, North Dakota, Democrat. Senator Michael B. Enzi, Wyoming, Republican. Senator Charles E. Grassley, Iowa, Republican. Senator Olympia Snow, Maine, Republican. The White House. So you can tell President Obama to veto any bill that doesn't contain the public option. And on an update, the author looked up state populations as of 2008 and calculated that all six of the senators put together represent just under 8.5 million people. This is roughly the same as the population of New York City.
That's fascinating that six senators that represent a population equal to the city of New York are in the kingpin seat for determining what health reform or lack of health reform we're going to get. Okay, we got a caller. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Hello. I highly recommend that the people read the book The Nature of Personal Reality by Jane Roberts. It explains our relationship to the medical profession and our own bodies, and how the individual, through the conscious thinking mind, does affect the health of the body. So by utilizing our own abilities to heal our bodies, we can totally bypass any of these outside things from our relationship thereof.
Okay, thank you. Give us the name of the book again.
The Nature of Personal Reality by Jane Roberts.
Thank you very much. Have a good day. Okay, carrying further in the vein of healthcare and the discussion of healthcare reform. This is from a guy named Ed Schultz. He's speaking and writing on the Ed Schultz Show, and it's published by opednews.com. I'm not an economist, and I can't follow his reasoning as I don't understand some of his labels, but I find his conclusion worth reporting. He calls his article Healthcare and the Demand Curve, Why the Free Market Will Always Fail. Government's the only way that healthcare will ever be accessible to those who need it, because there's no downward sloping demand curve. A downward sloping demand curve is essential for a market to regulate. The demand curve charts the quality of a good service or service demanded at any price. It's downward sloping because the higher the price, the lower the quantity demanded will be, unless you're talking about something that will save your life. A fundamental of economics is that individuals buy or don't buy based upon what they believe will maximize their utility at any given point. This is referred to as the law of demand. If the option buy saves my life, I'm going to buy as much as is necessary at any given price to protect myself or the ones I love. Life is even more addictive than cocaine. How much will a cocaine junkie give for their drug? Everything, no matter how much it is. The crackhead in the ghetto does it just like Elton John did it, over and over. It's the same principle. If the demand curve is not downward sloping, the market will never reach equilibrium price. People would sell themselves into servitude for a couple of pills to save their life. At those prices, the cost of health care is too high. Any time that demand is not in any way a function of price, the government must set the price. A responsible government would not allow life-saving health care to cost whatever you got. A responsible government would not allow life-saving health care to be denied to those who can't afford it, especially when the price is not fixed by demand. Because even if everyone could afford it today, that would simply allow the price to rise even higher until those at the bottom, again, could not afford it. The right wing claims to believe in the free market whenever possible, but they understand it or even recognize any of its clear failures. Their solution for everyone who doesn't have insurance is to get insurance, but that's not possible no matter how much they earn. Universal health insurance just leads to further price inflation until there is less than universal coverage because it facilitates the runaway demand curve. The only solution is for the government to set the prices. Of course, I don't think that the right wing is looking for a solution. They're perfectly content letting members of our society die if it cuts down on their waiting time, meaning that they aren't interested in being a part of society at all. The most likely response to this from the right wing is distraction, followed closely by denial. But mark my words that none can argue with the economic facts asserted here, which means that they don't have any argument at all. There is no free market solution to the health care crises. The sooner we recognize this, the sooner we can start controlling the costs of health care to accessible rates. Avi, you want to read the next one?
Yes. This is from an email. If you do not pay attention to any other information on this topic, please read this and listen to the Thompson interview. Take the time. We all need to be informed. This is not about party preference. This is about our human right to life. We do need reform, not life control, not more entitlement. It's time to contact our representative, folks. On page 425 of Obama's health care bill, the federal government will require everyone who is on Social Security to undergo a counseling session every 5 years, with the objective being that they will explain to them just how to end their own life earlier. Yes, they are going to push suicide to cut Medicare spending. It further states that paying for your own care will not be an option. If you listen to the interview, Betsy McCoy also states that the government is lying to us when they say that the new health care bill will allow you to keep your present health care plan if you so choose. She states that on page 16 to 17, the bill specifically prevents you from keeping your present plan even if you want to. The article concludes with the following exhortation. Now, call your people in Washington. Tell them to read page 425 if they don't read anything else. Surely some of them have parents. And finally, ends with the following quotes. When injustice becomes law, rebellion becomes duty. When the government fears the people, you have liberty. When the people fear the government, or the IRS for that matter, you have tyranny. That was Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence of the United States. Page 425 of proposed health care bill. Listen to this interview on Fred Thompson's radio. Or look it up on www.fredthompsonshow.com.
Okay, and the bill that she's referring to is the bill that's being proposed in the Congress. Page, what is it, 425 or 465?
425.
Okay.
That was Betsy McCoy.
Okay, well, I'm a little reluctant to read the following article because I have a gut-level reaction to some of the author's language, primarily his continuing reference to Zionist-occupied America. But I think he has an interesting perspective, so I read, you decide. It's titled, Putin Rebukes Zionist America and Obama. The author calls himself Brother Nathaniel Kapner. It's published in 4winds10.com. And it also seems to be published in www.realzionistnews.com. Here's the article. The U.S. should take a lesson from the pages of Russian history, scolded Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin during a speech at the opening ceremony of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, in January of this year. Continuing his lecture, to Zionist-occupied America, Putin said that America should not exercise, quote, excessive intervention in economic activity while having blind faith in the state's omnipotence, close quote. Then, pointing to a few of the tragic events of Russia's economic woes during its occupation by communism during the Soviet Union-era days, Putin issued this pointed message to the U.S., quote, because the Soviet Union made the state's role absolute, it made the Soviet economy totally uncompetitive. This lesson cost us dearly. I'm sure nobody wants to see it repeated. Close quote. Putin's rebuke of Zionist America comes at a time when Obama is initiating the largest expanse of American government in the history of the U.S. With his latest appointment of the Zionist Jew Kenneth Feinberg as pay czar to monitor the compensation of private businessmen, Obama should be listening to the sage advice of Vladimir Putin. We must not turn a blind eye to the fact that the spirit of free enterprise, including the principle of personal responsibility of business people, investors, and shareholders for their decision, is being eroded. There's no reason to believe that we can achieve better results by shifting responsibility onto the state. That's Putin speaking. With the U.S. deficit climbing to over $2 trillion, an extremely conservative figure, under the Obama administration, Putin's words are coming home to roost. We must assess the real situation and write off all hopeless debts. True, this will be an extremely painful and unpleasant process. However, we would only prolong the crisis unless we clean up our balance sheets. On the eve of his first visit to Russia, which was in July of this year, Obama accused Prime Minister Putin of having one foot in the Cold War, when actually it's Obama who's waging Cold War policies with his wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, and blowing hot and cold towards Iran. In his interview with the Associated Press, Obama not only made the mistake of alienating Putin by calling him a Cold War politician, suggesting that Russia's President Medvedev's outlook different from Putin's, but made an attempt to pit Medvedev against his mentor and boss, Prime Minister Putin. Quote, as we move forward with President Medvedev, it is important that Putin understand that the old Cold War approaches to U.S.-Russian relations are outdated, that it's time to move forward in a different direction. Close quote. I think Medvedev understands that. I think Putin is one foot in the old ways of doing business and one foot in the new. Again, close quote. Putin responded to Obama's attack quickly with an obvious jab at Obama's rock star posturings. We don't know how to stand so awkwardly with our legs apart. We stand solidly on our own 2 feet and always look to the future. And responding to Obama's attempt to drive a wedge between himself and Medvedev, which demonstrated a total misreading of relations in the Kremlin, Medvedev is in office but not in power. Putin announced, Dmitry Medvedev is no less of a Russian nationalist than I am. Indeed, Medvedev's role as Russia's president depends entirely on Putin's support and intentions. As the Times Online reported, Medvedev may represent a more accommodating face of Russia, but this has only become Putin wants him to. In his two-hour breakfast meeting with Putin in July of this year, Obama was made subject to a one-hour interrupted monologue by Putin about Russia's view of the world. And it is Russia's view of the world that Obama must take second seat to. For Putin, being fully aware that Obama came to Russia to secure airspace passage through southern Russia to transport U.S. military supplies into Afghanistan, which Putin granted, found opportunity to demonstrate to Obama that it is Russia who's really in charge of Eurasian geopolitics, not Zionist-occupied America. Russia just signed an agreement with Azerbaijan to receive gas deliveries, which the U.S.-backed Nabucco project depend on. As planned by Putin, only 1 week prior to Obama's visit, the U.S. was granted the right to continue using the Manas Air Base in Kyrgyzstan, which was previously denied to America in February. Putin is believed to be behind the Central Asian nation's decision to originally evict U.S. troops, and his approval was sought when the U.S. and Kyrgyzstan announced the move's surprise reversal. Obama unconsciously admitted to Putin's growing dominance when in an interview with Fox News, Obama said, quote, I found Putin to be tough, smart, shrewd, very unsentimental, and very pragmatic, close quote. The tough, smart, and unsentimental Putin is dead set on reestablishing Russia's sphere of influence in the former Soviet republics, and Putin will continue to use Europe's dependence on Russian energy supplies as a card to divide Europe against Zionist-occupied America. And surely, while Obama's and his handlers attempt to get the Nabucco project off the ground, Putin will be working behind the scenes to see the project scrapped. Obama came to the Russian table like a card sharp to a casino, ready to charm his hosts and pull aces from his sleeve to win support from Europe for America's aim of continued but waning hegemony. But Putin's a master chess player, cautious and calculating. The unsentimental Putin does not respond to charm, and he has just closed Russia's casinos in his efforts to build a Christian Russia, while Obama continues to follow his orders to build a Soviet America. And amateur card players like Obama are simply tools, rather fools, for Putin to use in his new and expanding Russia. So there you have it, another view of the news from www.realzionistnews.com. Please keep in mind that once you get beyond the rhetoric and accept that this is not anti-Semitic, nor is it anti-Israel, but it is decidedly anti-Zionist, one could make a cogent argument over the Zionists' seeming power over America's foreign policy. And from that premise, one could then question the loyalties of many of the appointees to high positions in the American government. The question becomes, who is determining American foreign policy, and to what end? Okay, a couple of articles from the American Free Press. This one's out of the news, so I'm not sure what's happening with it, but I think it's of interest. There were two reporters that were arrested for spying in North Korea, and the question is, were they spying for the CIA? In early June, Laura Ling and Yuna Lee were convicted of grave crimes for the hostile activity of illegally entering North Korea. They were sentenced to 12 years of hard labor. Were there actual or alleged journalists? On March 19th, the Associated Press's Jean Lee reported that the two women were arrested after, quote, ignoring warnings to stop shooting footage of the reclusive country, close quote. Evidence showed that they illegally crossed the border, then upped the ante when they ignored orders to stop filming. North Korean soldiers then took them into custody. What makes this story even more intriguing is the fact that Laura Ling's sister, Lisa, entered North Korea under false pretenses in June of 2006 to film a National Geographic documentary entitled Undercover in North Korea. Posing as a volunteer for Nepalese eye doctor Sandak Ruit, Lisa Ling used miniature hidden cameras to capture damning images of the secretive regime. The young reporter then included material provided by the Department of Defense and State Department to produce a very harsh portrait of what she called the most terrifying country on earth. Though ignored in most news stories, two other individuals accompanied Lee and Ling in North Korea. One of them was a cameraman, Michael Koss, who's been an influential media insider for decades. According to the Asian American news site Epicanthus, which has closely followed the case, quote, Michael Koss is no mere cameraman. He's a wily veteran newsman, a pro's pro, who has reported from every hotspot on the globe for the past 30 years, close quote. Employed previously as a producer for CNN, ABC, and PBS, Koss has commanded an almost surreal level of access from usually secretive government agencies, such as the State Department, Department of Defense, DEA, and ATF. Koss was also an Al Gore's employee at Current TV when the two female journalists were arrested. That's not all. Koss acted as a mentor to not only Anderson Cooper of CNN, but also Lisa Ling, sister of the imprisoned journalist Laura Ling. There also appears to be a common agenda at hand. On August of 2003, Koss wrote an op-ed column for the LA Times entitled Refugees Could Undo Kim. Essentially, this article promoted the use of North Korean refugees to overthrow Kim Jong-il's regime. Coincidentally, when Lee and Ling were arrested, they were disguised as North Korean refugees, and the people they sought to interview were, as Gene H. Lee describes it, North Korean defectors hiding in China. The circumstances surrounding Koss get even stranger. As Lee and Ling fled from North Korea toward China before being apprehended, Koss escaped the border guards only to be arrested by Chinese authorities. They freed him several days later. Since that time, Casas remained in seclusion, refusing to comment on the case to anyone except the State Department. Some speculate that a fourth member of their party intentionally led them into a trap, but until Casas emerges from the shadows, the mystery persists. Does the CIA still use embedded media provocateurs and plants as they did during their Operation Mockingbird days? Todd Shields, of Editor and Publisher, answered this question in December of 2001. Quote, "The Central Intelligence Agency says its policy is not to use journalistic cover for its operations abroad, but it also says tough cases might force it to do so." Close quote. North Korea undoubtedly qualifies as a tough case. Are Una Lee and Laura Ling spies? It's not certain at this time. But as British Brian Selter of the New York Times wrote in June 8th, the detainment of two current TV employees has been shrouded in secrecy by the television channel. In addition, instead of publicly championing their cause, co-owner Al Gore, like Michael Koss, has steadfastly refused to comment. Their tepid reaction makes it difficult not to recall what former CIA Director William Colby quipped. The Central Intelligence Agency owns anyone of any significance in the major media. Okay, running low on time. And I can't find what I was going to read next. You got one there, Ravi?
Topic of jury nullification?
Yeah, go for it.
All right. Peers refuse to convict disabled vet in pot bust. This comes from the ragblog.blogspot.com. Quote, "Jurors should acquit, even against the judge's instruction, if exercising their judgment with discretion and honesty, they have a clear conviction the charge of the court is wrong." End quote. From Alexander Hamilton, 1804. Maybe this is how the war on marijuana ends. A rural Illinois jury has found one of their peers innocent in a marijuana case that would have sent him to prison. Loren Swift was charged with possession of marijuana with intent to deliver, and he faced a mandatory minimum of 6 years behind bars. The 59-year-old was arrested after officers from a state drug task force found 25 pounds of pot and 50 pounds of growing plants in his home in 2007. The Vietnam veteran walks with a cane, has bad knees and feet, and says he uses marijuana to relieve body pain, as well as to help cope with post-traumatic stress. This jury exercised their right of jury nullification. Judges and prosecutors never tell you this, but when you serve on a jury, it's not just the defendant on trial. It's the law as well. If you don't like the law and think applying it in this particular case would be unjust, then you don't have to find the defendant guilty, even if the evidence clearly indicates guilt. In a jury nullification, a jury in a criminal case effectively nullifies a law by acquitting a defendant, regardless of the weight of evidence against him or her. There is intense pressure within the legal system to keep this power under wraps. But the fact of the matter is that when laws are deemed unjust, there is the right of the jury not to convict. Jury nullification is crucially important because until our national politicians show some backbone on the issue of marijuana law reform, it's one of the only ways to avoid imposing hideously cruel mandatory minimum penalties on marijuana users who don't deserve to go to prison. Prosecuting and jailing people for marijuana wastes valuable resources, including court and police time and tax dollars. Hundreds of thousands of otherwise productive, law-abiding people have been deprived of their freedom, their families, their homes, and their jobs. Let's save the jails for real criminals, not pot smokers. The American public is very near the tipping point where a majority no longer believes the official line coming from drug warrior politicians and their friends at the ONDCP. Gung-ho narcotics officers protecting their profitable turf, and sensationalistic, scaremongering news stories used to boost ratings. They are starting to see through the widening cracks in the wall of denial when it comes to marijuana's salutary medical effects on a host of illnesses and its palliative effects for the terminally ill and permanently disabled. People are coming to realize that not only have they been sold a lie when it comes to marijuana, they've been sold a particularly cruel lie, a self-perpetuating falsehood of epic proportions that has controlled U.S. public policy towards the weed for 70 years now. The extreme cruelty of the lies told about marijuana by drug warriors is in effect this culture of fear and intolerance has in the real world. Effects like long prison sentences for gentle people who are productive and caring members of society. Because the citizens are coming to this long-delayed realization, we are going to be seeing more and more cases like this where juries have to choose not to punish people for pot. As this consciousness permeates all levels of society, it is going to get harder and harder for prosecutors to get guilty verdicts in marijuana cases, and that's a good thing. Maybe this is how the war on marijuana ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper. What you can do. If you ever serve on a jury where the defendant is accused of a marijuana crime, don't forget about jury nullification. Tell the other jurors you don't have to convict, even if all the evidence points to guilt. If you don't agree with the application of the law in this instance, and if you can't swing your peers to your way of thinking, at least you can cause the jury to return a hung verdict.
Thanks, Avi. Okay, finally, there's a health alert from your intrepid rabble-rousing reporters. I'm sure listeners are aware of the health risks of some chocolates imported from China, as those silly Chinese health inspectors allowed the toxic chemical melamine to contaminate some of their chocolate products. However, you may not be aware of the serious ramifications of this problem. Our intrepid British correspondent provides us with this important news from the United Kingdom. To understand the seriousness of this, a few explanations of British slang are in order. Ann Summers is the name of a sex shop chain store in Britain. Both Willie and Todger refer to the male sex organ. It seems that whether attached to the British or any other nationality, Willies are...